justice and that King Ziglar presiding, your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Before we begin our second oral argument this morning, I want to acknowledge that we have Court with Class with us today, South Milwaukee High School. We have 60 visitors, I think. If you could please stand. Wow, it's great to have a courtroom full of students like you. So welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. If Jim Grassel is here, if you could remain standing, the rest of you can go ahead and sit down. It's not often on the spot, so we're going to have the chance to do that. I just want to acknowledge that my colleague to my left, Rebecca Grassel Bradley, is the sister of Jim, and he teaches AP government and history and has been teaching for 30 years, 24 years with South Milwaukee High School. I think this is your second visit. I got to embarrass you a little bit last time you were here, and I wanted to make sure I did that again, if at all possible. If your mother is listening, she should know she has some really great children, and it's wonderful to have you here today to join us. So I want you to feel very welcome.
Thank you, Chief. Mom is watching. Hi, Mom.
My mother-in-law and my parents used to always watch it. It was funny because they'd be like, do you have a cold? You sounded kind of... it's an interesting way for your parents to keep track of you and make sure you're where you say you are, among other things. All right, now to the business at hand.
I don't know, this is too much fun.
It is a little bit of fun. Maybe you can stand up again. Let's try. All right. The oral argument today, second one, is 23 AP 645 CR, State versus McAdory? McAdory. Perfect. Thank you. So if you could start with stating your appearances. All right, welcome to both of you. 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay, with that, let's start.
Chief Justice, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Attorney Olivia Gordon, and I represent Mr. Carl McAdory. This is a case about circuit court power. The state may try to convince you that this is a case about holding impaired drivers accountable, but that is not true. The state, consistent with McAdory 1, still has the ability to retry Mr. McAdory for the OWI and hold him accountable through that offense. It is only the state's failure to do so that would result in Mr. McAdory escaping accountability.
What was your first sentence about this case is about what?
This is a case about circuit court power, Your
Honor. And what kind of power does a circuit court have?
Well, Your Honor, the circuit courts in Wisconsin derive their powers from the Wisconsin Constitution, the statutes, and also their inherent authority that is needed to conduct the business of a court.
Our case law says that this court has express authority, as you would find in the Constitution or statutes. It has implied authority. It has, of course, inherent authority as an institution, and it has incidental authority. This is a tough question, and I've been looking for the answer, and I don't have it. So if you don't have it, that's okay. Does the circuit court as an institution, we know it has inherent authority, there are cases that say that. Barland is a good example of a case. I was in the dissent, so I thought it was a bad example at the time, but it is an example of inherent authority. But what about the other types of authority? Clearly, when they have express authority, that's off the question arena. But implied authority, does the circuit court have implied authority or as an institution or incidental authority as an institution?
Your Honor, I certainly think that there are powers that a circuit court exercises that don't fit neatly within one of the boxes that could be considered implied or incidental powers. But I don't believe that that category of power should be so expansive to allow courts to essentially do something completely unprecedented and something that is not necessary for the court to actually function as a court.
That sounds like a very reasonable and articulate response. Do you have any authority for those premises that you just advanced?
Your Honor, while this court has recognized inherent authority in certain areas, I don't believe that it has recognized
implicit or incidental
powers. For example, in State versus Schwind from this court out of 2019, the court said that inherent authority in that third area to effectuate, to ensure the efficient and effective functioning of the court, that courts should only perform functions in this third area when that function is necessary for the court to act as a court. And without that power to act in that way, the court would cease to function as a court. And to be quite honest with the court, I can't think of a situation where a court not having the ability to reopen a judgment of conviction after an appeal to swap the basis of conviction, if the court doesn't have that power, how it would cease to function as a court. The court can still retry Mr. McAdory for the OWI offense and function as a court in that way and hold him accountable through those means.
Counsel, I wanted to ask about the charges, the RCS charge that was dismissed. Is there anything in the record that indicates whether that was with prejudice or not with prejudice, and does that matter to your argument at all?
Your Honor, certainly the state did not utter the words with or without prejudice, and nor did the court. However, I would argue that that dismissal was with prejudice. This court has recognized that circuit courts have inherent authority to dismiss charges, but they don't have the inherent authority to dismiss charges with prejudice until jeopardy has attached. And in this case, jeopardy attached when the jury was sworn in. And then after jeopardy attached, the state made the decision to dismiss that RCS charge. So I do believe that that dismissal should be with prejudice.
If it was not with prejudice, let's assume that it was not with prejudice. How does that affect your argument, if at all?
Your Honor, I don't believe it would impact the analysis if it was without prejudice, simply because the circuit court does not have any source of power with which it can revive a previously dismissed charge. Certainly, the state could refile a new criminal complaint.
What do you mean they don't have the ability to do that? If a motion is brought to, you know, reconsider given the facts and circumstances, why can't they revive it, especially given the fact that the defendant here was convicted of it?
Your Honor, I think that the important distinction to consider is the fact that this happened after an appeal was taken, and this was not simply the court reconsidering its own order within the scope of that proceeding. This is a court essentially taking the Court of Appeals decision that mandated a new trial for Mr. McAdory. And
on the OWI charge, not the RCS charge.
Yes, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals did issue an order for a new trial on the OWI because that was the only charge.
So go back to Justice Protasiewicz's question. So answer her. You answered her question by saying the Court of Appeals ordered a retrial on the OWI. I didn't hear that to be her question. I heard her question focusing on the RCS charge.
Right, and I believe that the court could not simply revive that RCS offense after an appeal because it's not reconsidering its own decision. At that point, it's considering the Court of Appeals decision, and the Court of Appeals decision, the circuit court does not have the authority to reverse that or in any way.
The Court of Appeals decision had nothing to do with the RCS charge. You're flipping them. Go ahead.
I certainly do not intend to, Your Honor. The The reason that the circuit court did not have the authority to do anything with the RCS offense is simply because that offense was not before the Court of Appeals during Mr. McAdory's first appeal. If the RCS dismissal was an error, if that was in fact erroneous for the state to move to dismiss that charge, it should have appealed that dismissal in Mr. McAdory's first appeal. But it failed to raise that in Mr. McAdory's first appeal, and so therefore it could not then raise that defense to the judgment of conviction after the circuit
That would be insane, because I'm sorry, it wouldn't make any sense for them. That it was dismissed because the statute says you can only be sentenced on one. So your client was not sentenced on the RCS charge. He was sentenced on the OWI charge. You appealed the OWI charge. The Court of Appeals said they said that they found in your favor on the OWI charge. They sent it back to the circuit court. They said, circuit court, you need to address the OWI charge, but they didn't say you can't do anything on the RCS charge, and it wouldn't make any sense for the state to appeal the dismissal of the RCS charge when it had been dismissed according to the statute, which says you can only sentence someone on one of these charges.
And Your Honor is certainly correct that only one charge can be sentenced and convicted. However, I would point the court to a different statute, to section 808.08, which provides the three actions that the trial court is permitted to take after it receives the remitter from the Court of Appeals or from this court. And section 808.08 provides that circuit courts can take three actions on remand. The first action is if the court is ordered to take a specific action by the Court of Appeals, it must take that action. The second option is if it's ordered to provide a new trial, it must place the matter on its trial calendar. And then third, it can undertake further proceedings as is necessary given the Court of Appeals' decision. But an important distinction that this court has repeatedly reinforced is that the trial court does not have the jurisdiction to reopen the Court of Appeals' decision, set it aside, modify it, or do anything in regard thereto except to enforce it.
Counsel, I want to follow up on that. I find this argument a little confusing. The Court of Appeals says here below that your reading the first McAdory 1 wrong. So it feels a little odd to me that your argument in part depends upon reading the Court of Appeals decision, McAdory 1, to be different than what the Court of Appeals itself says it was saying. And you're asking us to enforce a particular understanding that the Court of Appeals itself says, no, we never said that. We never said you couldn't do that. Nothing in our order says that. But your argument seems to depend upon basically telling the Court of Appeals in McAdory 2 that it was wrong, which just strikes me as odd. I don't quite follow.
Well, Your Honor, while courts certainly have the authority to interpret their own mandates, I think the words that courts use do matter. And when the court in McAdory 1 remanded and reversed for a new trial on the OWI, it was anticipating that a new trial would occur on the OWI and not that something else would happen.
But the Court of Appeals has since clarified, no, that's not what we said.
And I agree that the Court of Appeals did say that that is the interpretation of its mandate from McAdory 1.
Doesn't the Court of Appeals have the authority to interpret and clarify its own mandate?
Your Honor, yes. This court has said that courts do have that authority to interpret their own mandates, but when a court reverses for a new trial, really the only thing that the statute provides for is that a new trial occur.
A new trial or a dismissal, because the prosecution's not required to go ahead, correct?
Certainly, Your Honor. And there are cases where, after remand for a new trial, a plea agreement is reached, and that could possibly happen. However, the statute puts the onus on the trial court to place the matter on its trial calendar.
So doesn't the trial court then have the inherent authority to resuscitate the dismissed count, because it was only dismissed because of the conviction on the count that had the remand?
I, I, I don't believe that the court would have the inherent authority to simply revive that charge and enter a judgment of conviction on that charge. I think it might be a separate question if we were talking about retrying both of the charges together. But I don't believe that the court has the inherent authority to simply reopen a judgment of conviction after an appeal.
What if after the trial the court entered judgment of convictions on both counts, but only... Oh, you couldn't do that because the statute says...
But it finished that in, but only what?
Well, if you had entered the judgment of conviction, but you only sentenced on the one count.
I don't believe that would be permissible under the...
Yeah.
So what do you think, following up on that, what would you have the state do? Because the statute's clear that you can only, there shall be a single conviction for purposes of sentencing and for purposes of counting convictions. So if we were to rule in your favor, what would you have the state do?
I would have the state retry Mr. McAdory for the OWI.
But they... Okay. All right. In this type of case, how would you foresee them proceeding when the jury convicts of both counts as they did here?
Your Honor, I think that the counties certainly take different approaches to that right now, and I think that is an important aspect for this court to provide clarity on. My position is that the dismissal of that second offense is permanent, and that it should...
Right, but where does it say you have to dismiss it? The statute doesn't say dismissal.
Right, the statute doesn't say dismissal. That comes from the Town of Menasha versus Bastion case from the Court of Appeals.
Where did the Court of Appeals get it?
Your Honor, I believe that the Court of Appeals was taking this court's decision from Fowichev to its logical conclusion. This court in Fowichev said that the dual prosecution scheme didn't violate double jeopardy because we only allow one conviction and one punishment. And under Wisconsin law, there simply is no mechanism to allow a charge to simply remain pending in perpetuity.
Well, and so let's talk about that a little bit. You know, I handled a bunch of these cases in Fort Milwaukee, and different judges handled them differently. On a plea, virtually all the time, a person pled to one count, the other count was dismissed. But there were judges where, in cases like this, when the matter went to trial, they entered the conviction and sentenced on one count and left the other count just hanging out there, so to speak, in the event that there would be an appeal and in the event that the case would come back, so that charge stayed out there. And if you think about it, that charge isn't really hanging in perpetuity because that case has one case number, right? And so that case is going to be closed after the sentencing on one count. So would you be here today if the circuit court had just held one of those counts in abeyance?
I don't know if we would be here, but certainly I believe Mr. McAdory would have appealed that decision.
And tell us why.
Because the Town of Menasha versus Bastion case clearly says that the other charge must be dismissed. So I don't believe that holding...
Because you can't be convicted of two.
Correct. The statute speaks of conviction and sentence, right. However, that the Town of Menasha versus Bastion case requires that the other charge be dismissed.
It seems the case read out of the statutory text, the language that says there shall be a single conviction for purposes of sentencing and for purposes of counting convictions, which suggests that there could be more than one conviction for other purposes.
And I believe that this court actually has already conclusively answered that question in State versus Bowichev, because in Bowichev the defendant did raise those other purposes that the secondary conviction, let's say, could be used for, such as impeaching a witness while testifying or the repeater statute. And this court said that, no, there is not one conviction for purposes of counting convictions and for sentencing and two convictions for other purposes. There is one conviction for all purposes.
Well, then this court must have read out the text, the language from the text about for purposes of. Would you agree with that? Because it's rendered completely superfluous then under that analysis of the existing cases that have addressed it.
Your Honor, I don't necessarily agree that it made that language superfluous. I do understand where Your Honor's coming from with that point. I would argue that that language is specific to driver's license penalties that occur after impaired driving convictions. So certainly this court could find that Bowachev read those words out of the statute, but I believe that they do serve an important clarifying purpose as well for administrative purposes for driver's license revocation.
So go back to my question from before. Why couldn't, if there were a trial and there were convictions for both OWI and a restricted controlled substance, why couldn't, there were guilty verdicts on both, why couldn't a judge enter a judgment of conviction on both, and then under this statute just rely on one of those convictions, the single conviction, for the purpose of sentencing?
Your Honor, I don't believe that that would be permissible under the plain language of the statute. The plain language speaks of a single conviction, and if the court...
But it's that next phrase that Justice Rebecca Bradley was just pointing out that is doing a lot of work here, for the purpose of sentencing. So, right, there's one. The person isn't going to be sentenced on both the OWI and the controlled substances charge. The person is only going to be convicted. There shall be a single conviction for the purpose of sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that a court entering a judgment of conviction on both an OWI and an RCS offense would be permissible under this statute, because that is not the understanding that courts have been operating on. This court provided in Bowachev that the double jeopardy clause is not violated by this statute because it only allows for one conviction for all purposes. And the
Bowachev was decided in 1983. I don't have my cheater glasses on, but I think, thank you, Chief. And in doing this analysis that you've accurately relayed, the court said other indicia of legislative intent make it evident that it authorized only one conviction for all purposes. But we don't look at legislative intent. We try to discern what the legislature meant, which is different, what the statute means, which is sometimes perhaps different than what certain legislators might have thought they were enacting when they voted for a piece of legislation. So it seems that the whole case is under a framework that this court no longer utilizes. This court looks to the text. So it seems that there's an opportunity for this court to look at meaning, statutory meaning, and depart from examining or reinforcing what the legislature may have intended.
And, Your Honor, I agree that Bowachev used some language that this court does not use anymore, and perhaps indicated that it was going about the analysis of the statute in a different way, but I don't believe that that analysis is wrong under the current statutory framework. When we look at the plain meaning of the statute and what the statute means, the legislature has amended the statute 9 times since Bastion was decided in 1993, and I believe it was 10 times since this court decided Bowachev in 1983. And on none of those times has the legislature said, the court's got it wrong, and the court's need to change how they do OWI procedure. The legislature has repeatedly, not affirmatively stated, but has acquiesced to this interpretation of how we do OWI law in the state of Wisconsin, which is that after a jury returns a verdict of guilty, one is dismissed and the state elects the other charge to proceed on. Decisions have consequences.
Counsel, can I ask about your prejudice? I'm sorry, were you done?
I'm done. Go ahead.
I just want to ask about your, multiplicity argument. Your reply brief talks about sentence credit, and that looked to me to be a new argument. I spent a while trying to put my arms around it a little bit. So I wanted to ask you, am I reading correctly? I didn't read your argument in your principal briefs or anything along those lines on the Court of Appeals to at least address the possibility of a sentence credit argument, but you seem to reframe it in the reply brief that way. Am I reading that correctly? And if so, what are we supposed to do about that?
And, Your Honors, my warning light is on, so I just want to make sure that I have enough time to fully answer that question. The sentence credit issue, Your Honor, I believe goes to the double jeopardy question of whether multiple punishments are being inflicted on one defendant for the same act or occurrence, and whether the legislature has really intended for multiple punishments to be inflicted for one act or occurrence. And as this court has found, the legislature did not intend for multiple punishments to be inflicted on a defendant for violating multiple subsections of the Impaired Driving Act. So I don't believe that I don't believe it's a new argument. I think that it is an argument regarding the multiple punishments that could be inflicted.
Did you mention sentence credit at all in your earlier briefing? Or
I don't recall, Your Honor.
Okay. And it seemed that your argument there was also premised on the idea that you wouldn't receive credit, that the Department of Corrections wouldn't do it. I was curious, is that issue ripe? Has that happened? Have you received a determination that way? Because your argument seemed also depend upon that fact and of action. I just wasn't sure.
Your Honor, in Mr. McAdory's case, he did receive the credit that he spent for the OWI against the RCS offense, but I believe that the only reason he received that credit is because the circuit court ordered it, and the circuit court did not leave that determination of sentence credit to the Department of Corrections.
So that hasn't been appealed. It seems to me that if that at least question of multiple punishments for the same offense that you talked about, that maybe you didn't raise it, and it actually factually isn't before us. Is that fair?
That's fair, Your Honor. This is probably not the best vehicle for this court to determine that issue.
Thank you.
However, I do believe that what happened in this case is unlawful. The circuit court had no statutory, constitutional, or other authority to reopen a judgment of conviction after an appeal to swap the basis of conviction.
What about
conviction?
Paragraph 18 of the Court of Appeals opinion that indicates that there was implicit statutory authority?
Your Honor, I disagree with the Court of Appeals decision in that regard. I don't believe that anything in the text or structure of 346.63 sub 1 sub c provides inherent authority. That statute simply
provides what authority?
Provides any authority for what happened here. That statute simply talks about trying the cases, that the matter shall be joined for trial, and that there shall be one conviction. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justices, may it please the Court. Again, I am John Kellis, appearing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. While the parties disagree about nearly everything in this case, there's one thing we can agree on, and that is the procedural history that got us here should never happen again. The Court has the power to guarantee that, and it has options on how to do so. Above all, it should overturn Bastion because it's largely the reason we are here today. Without Bastion, the state dismisses no charges in Mr. McAdory's case. There likely wouldn't have been multiple appeals. Most of the issues that we've been arguing about here today likely don't come to fruition. And
if we find that a circuit court has inherent authority to, in this instance, reinstate the controlled substance in charge, then we wouldn't have to overturn Bastion. Is that right?
I agree. I think that the potential cleaner method is to recognize that Bastion did what we recognize they're not supposed to do and read into a statute words that aren't there in order to effectuate a particular result. But in the end, this court has options should it get to that point of overturning Bastion. You could let the circuit courts and the Court of Appeals decide how to effectuate the legislature's goal that's written in Section 346.63.1c, and hope that they get it right. Or it can, this court in itself can establish a procedure for what to do when a defendant is found guilty of multiple charges at trial, conviction and sentence is entered on one, and ultimately the defendant is successful in disturbing his conviction on appeal.
I read that in your brief, and I was looking for, quite frankly, I'm looking for the possibility of this being analyzed on something other than inherent authority, because I have a concern about the broad sweep of inherent authority. It doesn't mean that we don't use it. So when I came I find this case fascinating, by the way. I came across your suggestion in pages 22, 23, something like that, of doing superintending authority under Article 7, Section 3. And I thought, that sounds good, because that's what superintending authority generally is, to control litigation. That's a broad definition, but that's a broad sweep of what is often done, or procedures, under our superintending authority. And so I liked that, but then I got a little concerned about what we do about this case, right? Certainly, you know, the circuit court could not invoke our superintending authority, so it went with inherent authority. I mean, there are so many options as I see it here, some with strength, some with weaknesses, probably maybe all with strengths and weaknesses. This is your weakness. Your weakness, I think, is in the procedure that you set forth. On those pages, if I can pull them up in your brief. And the procedure is to kind of, I think, also appeal the dismiss the substance, controlled substance abuse, right? No, I don't mean abuse, controlled substance. Let me, I'm just trying to find it here. Yes, you set forth on page 23 and 22 how you see this should be unfolding. And you say at the top of 23 that the defendant can seek post-conviction and appellate relief, where he can argue about the OWI case. But not just that, you can argue about the case that here, the cause of action here that was dismissed, that you can appeal. My notes say you're arguing that can appeal both. Is that what you're arguing?
How I would envision it is that, and I, my apologies if it's not laid out well in my brief, the process would not involve a dismissal. So there would not be any of the charges that would be dismissed, because the statute, quite frankly, as the court recognized now, it doesn't call for that. It simply says there should be one conviction
so
for
what
purposes.
Is your process?
So then once that happens, there would not be a dismissal, whether it's, I think, as potentially Justice Grofsky had acknowledged or had pointed out, an idea is potentially just having a judgment. It could be for multiple offenses, but there's effectively just a sentence for, or a sentence imposed for the RCS charge. If that's the mechanism that would allow it to go forward, the alternative, I think, is, as we pointed out in our brief, Rule 80910 sub 4, effectively brings forth to the appellate court those orders and adverse rulings prior to the final judgment. So I think you get there really either way, whether it's...
My concern when I was reading this was that you were forgetting the statute that deals with finality, 808.03 sub 1. And we just had a case, well-written case, that came out of this court on January 22nd. entitled Morey versus Morey. That I laugh because if someone else laughs because they know who wrote the case.
I think we all know.
but it follows on this Wambold case that we previously had, too, and that is that in order to have an appeal, really, you have to have a final order or judgment. And I thought your recommendation here ran afoul of 808.03(1). How can you take to the appellate court something where you don't have a final order or judgment, unless it's an interlocutory order, and that's not relevant here?
No, I don't believe so. I think it really is the fact that they would be appealing from the actual issued judgment of conviction that is issued at the end. So once they're found guilty, the sentence is imposed. They're appealing from that judgment of conviction.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question about...
Stop you there. You're losing the part in the statute where it says you can only be a single conviction for purposes of sentencing. You've now just got us being sentenced on one. What happened to the other one?
Sort of sentenced on.
Yeah, that
other.
Doesn't. I mean, what you're saying is appealing. Like, we'll just let it hang out there. Why would we dismiss it? It doesn't say the word dismiss, but in the reality is just from a functional standpoint and how we do courts and finality and all that is that. What does that look like? You just said a single you said you'd have a conviction and a judgment of conviction and a sentencing and then an appeal, but you can only have one. So what happens to the other one?
There is the single judgment of conviction. So in this case, well, I guess because of the path, it's probably not a good example, but say in the original McAdory one, we have, instead of dismissing the RCS charge, we enter the judgment of conviction on the OWI charge. The court still accepts the verdicts, though, for all of the charges, including the RCS charge. And then by operation of 809.10(4), I think that brings forward then that prior, the verdict as well with that judgment that supports the OWI.
Do you see a problem of this impacting other types of cases where you can, now we're saying you can appeal something where there's been no judgment of conviction entered? I mean, doesn't that open up a whole can of worms?
But let me jump in here. I think a judgment of conviction, counsel, if I'm understanding you, is in fact entered. And the judgment of conviction would list one of those counts as if he has been convicted, but by operation of law, no sentence is imposed. Is that what you're saying?
I think that is one of the routes that can be done. I recognize that the way the statute is written, it provides for one conviction for counting and for sentencing purposes.
Yeah, but
I also acknowledge that this court in Bohachev really kind of extrapolated on that further to say that it was for all purposes. But again, even that's not really what's prescribed by the statute. So I get that this is a unique statute, if nothing else, in that I've looked to try to find something comparable where we'd have similar statutes under Wisconsin law. Haven't found something directly on point to see how it could be done in the other, I guess, context. But at the end of the day, the statute doesn't provide that guidance. It doesn't say how to effectuate that end result. And it's why I think we need guidance from this court on how we get there.
Can you identify any legal or statutory or constitutional problems with entering more than one judgment or entering a judgment of conviction on more than one count? And then following the statute, which says there shall be a single conviction for purposes of sentencing and counting convictions.
I think for constitutional, I guess the implications of that, as discussed a little bit earlier, there's kind of a new multiplicity argument being made. But at the end of the day, we don't have a successive prosecution. We don't have a successive prosecution double jeopardy issue. If the argument that's being made is multiplicity, and it's not even because it's the same offense, it's whether the legislature intended multiple punishments. If there is this judgment, and there's no penalty imposed for the two different offenses, then you wouldn't have the multiplicity issue either. So I don't see any issue, any constitutional ramifications of entering a judgment for the multiple offenses as long as there is no punishment imposed for both.
Well, counsel, what about Bohachev? I mean, Bochef was, the argument there was that if you particularly have collateral consequences, that would be a problem from a multiplicity standpoint. So the court says we don't need to get to that question because we read the statute as imposing one conviction for all purposes, and reject the argument that it that you would enter multiple judgments of conviction but only impose a sentence or for counting. So I don't, there could be, I mean, we haven't addressed that question, I mean, but that issue was raised in Bochef as to whether, at the very least, the collateral consequences attendant to multiple convictions might raise that when the at least the argument is that the legislature clearly intended only one kind of punishment at all for this incidence or occurrence that led to these, you know, led to the charge.
But I think that that's, I'm sorry, but I think that that's really the issue here, is that if the legislature wanted to be clear, it wanted, you know, one conviction for any possible consequence, whatever those might be, it could have put that in the statute. It made clear it was for sentencing and counting purposes.
Yeah, I agree. I guess my question I'm having here, and I totally understand the appeal of that read of the statute, you didn't make an argument to overturn Bochef before us. I'm not sure what the ramifications of that are, including for constitutional purposes. So they're also, you know, Bochef's 1983. You have the Court of Appeals explicitly applying it to 346-63. Later, in 2000, I think it was, you have multiple statutes that were enacted after copying the same language from Bochef. And adding that in, applying it to other kinds of, areas. We have the same kind of duplication, motor vehicle carriers, commercial motor vehicles. So there's some interesting statutory arguments here about, what the legislature has done since 1983 on this case. You can respond to that, but I just have one other question maybe I'll throw at you, and that is, I'm curious what your take is on the Court of Appeals argument in this case. A little more fully. Because your argument I found interesting after I finished reading through it, you didn't take up their argument at all, even though their reasoning would lead you to win. You seem to focus purely on the inherent authority argument rather than the implied kind of statutory authority to do this sort of thing. So I'd love to hear whether you agree with it, disagree with it, whether you have any color you want to add to that.
So the thing about the Court of Appeals vision is, I think what it was, and I, the court would clearly know better than I do what it was intending. But really, I think in many ways it was engaging in a, whether it was an inherent authority or something along those lines, in labeling it something besides that. And maybe it was an aversion to framing this as inherent authority or something like that. But to call something implicit statutory authority, I think both sides are in agreement that the statute doesn't really provide for that. I mean,
isn't that what implicit means? I mean, obviously it doesn't provide for that. That's a real difficulty we have here. It provides for the single conviction, but then is silent as to the rest. So I thought the Court of Appeals was reading between the lines in the statute, and as it's mostly in paragraph 18. I mean, there are several ways of trying to solve this. This is one, and this seems to me the route that is the most, arguably, the most restrained, right? The least difficulty in having residual problems. You heard Justice Hagedorn talk about concerns regarding maybe some unintended consequences if we were going to go your route. All of them have strengths and weaknesses, but this is the most restrained, I think, other than the one that I came up with, which was really good. and that is superintending authority and then dismissed a la Bastion the case of Bastion, but then the dismissal for purposes of these, this specific statute and its companion statutes, deemed them dismissed without prejudice. That's one way of doing it, but the Court of Appeals seems to be pretty darned restrained, too. And that's attractive to me. You know, do no harm. Some of the justices on this court believe that, right, Justice Hagedorn?
Yeah, that's
right. And I agree that I understand the court's reluctance to exercise its superintending authority. It's inherent authority. I guess what my thought is about the Court of Appeals decision is that whether you call it inherent statutory authority, inherent judicial authority, superintending authority, however you want to couch it. I mean, in the end, the statute doesn't say you can do this. The route that it gets there, whether it's because the circuit court effectively can't do anything with this statute because the statute doesn't say how you are supposed to effectuate its goal, you could read that as saying, well, it implicitly authorizes this because it gives us a goal without telling us how to get there, whether you call it implicit statutory authority or whether you're calling it it's the inherent authority because if we don't do this, we can't function as a court. We can't effectively apply this statute and employ it as the legislature commanded because there's really no way for us to know what we're supposed to do with these particular charges.
Other than the sentence right after what we're talking about says this would allow the court to accomplish the explicit purpose, paragraph 18, of the provision set forth in the statute. So, you know, that's what it's headed for. Let me follow up. The judge here, the trial court judges, I don't want to say anything for the record lest it be held against me by other judges, but really good and a real good judge. And he had the experience of, as he says in footnote 3 at the end of his opinion, that he's been both a municipal judge and then a circuit court judge for quite some time. And he has a suggestion on how we should proceed in the future. Have you had an opportunity to review that? It's a four-part.
I believe so. I'm not sure.
If you haven't, that's okay, because I don't want to, you know, catch you by I'm serious. I don't want to catch you by surprise or unprepared. But he has an outline of how this case should be used in the future.
I mean, in the end, I think we can all agree on something. And that is, again, to go back to kind of my opening point, is that the procedural history in Mr. McAdory's case, no one prefers it. I mean, we understand, the toll that it has taken to get through this many steps in the appellate process. This wasn't a case involving a victim, but, you know, in a case in which we have a victim, we don't want to put them through that as well. This is not an ideal situation, and we recognize that. And that's the reason why we would like to try to come up with something that works to ensure that, you know, Mr. McAdory has his day in court. He has the ability to appeal any trial errors that affected his conviction or any of the jury's verdicts. But at the same time, we don't have a situation in which a defendant is found guilty of multiple charges and simply by happenstance, picking one charge over another, that's going to result in, a defendant basically not risking any conviction for one of the guilty verdicts and at most potentially having a retrial on another. I get that it's easy to lay blame on the state in this case and say you should have simply just picked the other charge. But that's not always going to be evident. I mean, there's going to be issues in which a post-conviction relief might have something to do with, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel, something that's not evident during the trial. And to say that, well, the state should just choose better, make sure you pick the one that's not prone to reversal, I think it kind of ignores how these trials proceed and the, you know, I guess how everything should happen here.
Do you deem, do you find any collateral consequences that are negative with an approach of superintending authority, as you assert, but with the approach of dismissing without, deemed it dismissed without prejudice in this narrow cabinet to this kind of situation where you have a statute that has multiple charges and only ability to have one conviction?
I guess my only concern would be as far as any type of double jeopardy implications. I mean, this doesn't fit the mold in that this would not be, if it came back following this dismissal without prejudice, would this be, I mean, it's not really a prosecution follow for the same offense following an acquittal because they weren't
right.
Acquitted. It wouldn't really be following a conviction either. I don't really see, I guess, an issue with that at first blush, but I'm sure if that's how the court writes this opinion, there very well may be someday, but I'm not aware of one.
Yeah, understandable. Can you address the your friend's 808.08 argument? I don't think you had a chance to address it in your brief.
It's page 9 of the reply brief, I believe.
I think they argue it in their first brief as well, but basically, page 9 in their reply brief. My understanding of their argument, and they talked about it, but it's like it, and Justice Hagedorn got to it as well, but it's the Court of Appeals told them to do X and they did Y. The Court of Appeals told the Circuit Court to reinstate the OWI charge and conduct a trial on that charge, and they didn't. Instead,
okay.
They went forward on the RCS charge.
No, I understand, and it really comes down to, so, you know, we they've had arguments about this competency argument, but really I think what it gets to is, yes, if, you know, following the remediator, the Circuit Court had various options that it could take. As far as that being an all-encompassing, not envisioning any other potential things that could happen, I think one of the things that was brought up was there could be dismissal. The state could just effectively say we can't pursue this charge. How I view this case, it's effectively the entering the conviction on another charge made the trial for the OWI redundant. Now, they could have pursued and they could have gone forward on that, but as we discussed with this multiplicity issue, there wouldn't have been any potential punishment that could have resulted from that. So I'm not surprised that having the judgment and sentence entered on the RCS charge, that it really made no sense to ultimately pursue the OWI charge as well. So we get to that same end result. Now, whether the error is simply by the Circuit Court not placing it on the trial calendar immediately versus, I get the argument. I guess I don't see where the harm came from not placing it on the trial calendar if it was going to be dismissed by action of this entering the RCS. Or the RCS conviction and sentence as well.
Counsel, was the RCS charge in this case dismissed with or without prejudice?
There was no reference to it being dismissed with or without prejudice.
Do you have an argument on that at all?
I acknowledge that because it happened during trial, at the conclusion of trial, I don't know if there would be a mechanism for it to have been without prejudice, I guess. But as we lay out in our brief, the fact that, you know, the double jeopardy ramifications of this would be whether there was this, whether there was the retrial for the same offense after conviction, acquittal, or multiplicity. In the end, it doesn't prevent... It did not prevent the I guess, the reinstatement of this. It did not subject Mr. McAdoo to double jeopardy. So I don't know if the differentiating between with prejudice and without ultimately has an impact here.
If a charge is dismissed with prejudice, can a circuit court change its mind?
I mean, I think, I guess I don't see why not, and I also can think of situations which a circuit court may dismiss with prejudice, but an appellate court reviewing that decides that that was incorrect and ultimately orders the charges reinstated as well. So I don't think that the simple fact of positive for the overall.
I sort of read the Court of Appeals opinion as basically doing exactly what you just said. Maybe I'm reading it wrong, but that basically, these things happen. Courts can, for a variety of different reasons, have the power that's there to reinstate these charges. And this statute, is silent on what to do in this particular circumstances. So this is within that general authority of the courts and within the statutory authority to do it. Again, maybe you disagree with that. You want to call it inherent authority, but in some respects, it feels like the Court of Appeals is doing exactly what you just said.
I agree, Your Honor. Again, a lot of this comes down to how we label it, I guess. It's whether you label it inherent authority or inherent statutory authority or superintending authority, however we get to that end result, I think that some of the mechanisms that we get there or how we get there, I really do think it comes down to just how it's being labeled. And I think that that's kind of the same for how the Court of Appeals framed this, whether you not want to call it inherent authority, but you want to say it's implicit statutory authority. I don't really necessarily know how we get it, if it's really much of a difference. I see my warnings light on. I think the few things I just want to wrap up with, as far as double jeopardy goes, we don't have a prosecution for the same offense after an acquittal. There was no acquittal. Prosecution for the same offense after conviction, again, no additional conviction. Multiple punishments, even if we want to get into the multiplicity issue that was raised for the first time in the reply brief, at the end of the day, neither Mr. McAdory, he certainly he received the credit, so he didn't receive this double punishment as reference. If it comes back before the circuit court, I guess I'm also kind of at a loss as to how the circuit court wouldn't ultimately afford that same credit as well. Some of the other arguments that were made, claim preclusion, I think we lay out really the fact that there wasn't a successive prosecution here, so there's not really a it wouldn't allow for this doctrine to apply, and I don't believe Mr. McAdory responded to that argument as well. And in the end, I guess I'll leave with this. Whatever the court does, recognize that we see that this process was not ideal, how this all played out. And if we can agree on something, it's that the court, we would like for the court to provide some guidance on how this should play out in this situation. So with that, I would ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Counsel, I just have one follow-up question. You have just a little time. This statute's been around for a long time.
It has.
How is this the first time we're addressing this question?
Be amazed at how much time I spent on Westlaw trying to find an instance in which, because it surprised me, quite frankly, having prosecuted OWIs for years in the DA's office as well, somewhat shocked to see that this same situation hasn't come up. Maybe it would have saved me a trip over here had it been, but thank you.
Thank you. Final? May it please the court. I really have two main points on rebuttal, and the first is that if the state's procedure
or, as Justice Bradley posited, a different procedure whereby the secondary charge, the RCS charge, is dismissed without prejudice. How I see that playing out is really in conflict with the appellate process that this court has laid down throughout decades of case law, and that is primarily the presumption against successive appeals. And Mr. McAdory's case, I think, is the perfect exemplar for this. He is convicted of the OWI and sentenced. He then appeals that conviction, is reversed and ordered a new trial, and then the court swaps the basis of conviction to the RCS, which was never reviewed by the Court of Appeals, and now we're in a situation where we're now appealing a separate issue and another appeal, and this just delays finality both for defendants but also victims of crimes as well.
But that's the structure the legislature set forth when they said you could only sentence on one of the convictions.
I agree, Your Honor, that that is how the legislature has set this up, that there can only be one appeal initially.
So your suggestion is, instead of taking a chance that there might be a second appeal, we ought to just dismiss the charge, then we don't have to worry about it anymore, because there won't be an appeal. That doesn't seem like justice for a victim either.
Your Honor, I don't necessarily think that that would deprive anyone of justice in that sense, in that if a conviction is reversed, it would most likely be reversed for an order for a new trial. And when appellate courts order new trials, there's no implication of the victim's rights in that situation. So I guess I don't...
Sure there is. Look, if you have a prohibited alcohol concentration charge that goes up on a test with the blood test for the intoximeter, say they, but they took a blood test for the controlled substances, you're not going to be able to retry the PAC charge, but you very well may be able to retry the RCS charge in that situation. You could sit and think of 100 different scenarios where what you're saying doesn't really hold water. I mean, the truth of it is, yeah, there is the possibility here for subsequent appeals, but that is the structure that is set. Look, in some ways, I want to say you're getting a huge break. Your guy's getting a huge break here. He was convicted of two crimes and he's only being sentenced on one. Come on. So in the end, no matter what happens here, your client is only going to be sentenced. If there's a conviction, your client's only ever going to be sentenced on one.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's how the legislature has set up OWI law. It has clearly intended only for one sentence, only for one punishment, even if there are...
Right, and no one in this courtroom is talking about anything else other than one sentence for one conviction.
Right, but I think when the court looks at the procedure that's used to effectuate that, what happened in this case is not... awful in my position, but it's not consistent with the presumption against successive appeals and against and Your Honors, I would just go back to the point that decisions have consequences. The state made the decision to dismiss the RCS offense when it was fully apprised of all of the facts in the law. It knew of the objections that Mr. McAdory made to the instructions given for the OWI offense, and it chose to dismiss the other offense. Actions have consequences. This court has repeatedly refused to rescue the state from strategic decisions gone awry, and that's what the state is asking this court to do in this case, to rescue it from its poor decision-making in dismissing the RCS offense when it clearly does not want to retry Mr. McAdory for the OWI. All Mr. McAdory is asking for in this case is that this court reverse the Court of Appeals and order him a new trial as was originally provided for by the Court of Appeals in McAdory 1. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Interesting oral argument. Again, welcome
to the class that we have here today. I would love to run out and say hello to you. I can't because I have a conference call, Zoom call on attorney recruitment and retention that started about 5 minutes ago, and I'm running it. So I need to go, but I do want to welcome you all, and I hope you enjoy your time here at the court, and I really do wish I could come out and spend a little time with you. All right, court is adjourned.